Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. I'm back here with all of you after a couple of weeks of break. The last time around, we couldn't have the program because of Swami's birthday celebrations, and the week before that, I was away. So it's nice to be back here and continue with the study of the Bhagavad Gita. We are in the middle of the fourth chapter, I think pretty much right in the middle of the fourth chapter. We covered a couple of verses last time. As always, I'll begin by giving you a short summary of what we covered in the previous episode, which was almost a fortnight ago. We covered two verses, 23 and 24, but pretty much very important and central to the concept which is going to be spoken of in the next four, five, or little more verses than that. Krishna starts speaking about the concept of yajna in verse number 23, which is going to be the theme for this section of the fourth chapter. But nevertheless, this entire description of or the topic of yajna comes right in between Krishna's description of a jnanistha. So he says the person is gatasangasya muktasya. That's the description how he begins. He says gatasangasya muktasya. Attachment has left and that person is liberated. Jnana avistita chetasaha. He has a mind in which jnana is deeply rooted. So this is clearly a description of a jnani, and such a person performs all actions like he is performing a yajna or a sacrifice. Having said that, in the very next verse, Krishna says, but the way such a person, who is a gatasangasya muktasya, how does he look upon this process of a yajna? It is completely different from how a regular person looks at a yajna. He says, in the jnani's view, brahmarpanam brahmahavihi. The process of offering or the means of offering is also Brahman. The offering being made, the havihi, is also Brahman. Brahmagnau brahmana utam. The fire in which the offering is made is also Brahman. The person making the offering is also Brahman. Brahmaivatena gantavyam brahma karma samadhina. And Brahman alone is reached by him who considers everything, every action as also Brahman. So that was the most important shloka that we covered, because that's one shloka most of Swami's devotees use on a regular basis as the food prayer. And much of what we discussed the last time around was more or less on how Krishna was bridging karma with jnana through upasana, and how this particular food prayer, the Brahmarpanam prayer, plays a very significant role in that. And in the larger context, we spoke of how the Bhagavad Gita itself was establishing that role, that karma, bhakti or upasana and jnana cannot be separated. They are a unified process, if you could put it that way. And over the years, many people speak of one being superior to the other, and they, you know, schools of wisdom, schools of philosophy are centered around that kind of a concept. And Bhagavad Gita comes to pretty much squash that idea and give us this understanding that all three are one. And that's one of the reasons why we chose to call this entire series a triune pilgrimage, because this is like a pilgrimage in what Swami would call the Triveni of bhakti, karma and jnana. So how does this happen? The Brahmarpanam, as I said, that shloka is still a description of a jnani. By making us use that as a food prayer, Swami is trying to make us aspire to that state of a jnani through the process of upasana. I'll speak about that briefly, because much of what we are going to go through is based on this concept. The next few verses that we are going to cover is about a statement that Krishna had made right in the third chapter, and I made a mention of this even the last time when we were discussing, which is that actions that are done as a yajna do not bind the person performing them. And this statement itself comes in a portion of the fourth chapter, which I just described, the verse number 23, where Krishna is actually describing the nature of a jnani. And One point that I've been saying through this entire portion, especially last week and the week before that, is that the description of jnani which Krishna is giving, much of it appears to be superfluous. Because the moment you say that a jnani sees nothing but Brahman everywhere, or that he has no feeling that he is a separate entity from the universe or the rest around, you have sufficiently described him. There's nothing more to say about a jnani. You don't have to then say that he has no desires, he is self-satisfied, he has no cravings, he sees this also as God, he sees that also as God. All of these descriptions seem to be pointless, because the moment you say that he sees everything as God, I think you've covered pretty much all of that. But nothing that Bhagavan says is ever superfluous, and there is always a purpose for every word that is spoken by Bhagavan. And when we look at these words with that attitude, we will see that all these are the sadhana being suggested for a karma yogi, right? And in the third chapter, he had said that live in this world and enjoy all that there is in it, but through this process of yajna. And in this chapter, as he describes in jnani, the subtle lessons is to consciously raise from that state of karma yoga to that of a jnani, which is the goal of karma yoga itself, right? So in that context, Krishna gives the Brahmarpanam mantra, what we use as the food prayer. So as the karma yogis, we consider the simple act of eating as a yajna, right? The very fact, as I mentioned last time, Brahmarpanam, the mantra describes a traditional yajna, right? Sitting in front of the fire and performing this traditional fire sacrifice is what is being described in this Brahmarpana mantra. By making us use that as a food prayer, Swami is making us look upon the simple act of eating food as a yajna, as a spiritual sacrifice. And not only that, the description which is being given here is that of a jnani. The jnani does not see all the objects involved in the sacrifice as being separate. So too, hopefully, through this process of upasana, we will be able to reach that state where we see everything as part of that same Brahman. Brahma eva tena gantavyam, brahma karma samadhinaha. That's why he ends with, whoever sees this will reach that state. Because this statement does not apply to a jnani at all. The moment you say that he is a jnani, then he identifies himself with Brahman. So Brahmaivatena gantavyam, he goes and reaches Brahman, is actually a meaningless statement to describe a jnani. Clearly states that this is a suggestion that is being made to each one of us who are trying to take up to the path of karma yoga, right? So in a sense, Krishna has been giving a comparison in a very subtle manner, right, between a karma yogi and a jnani. All these descriptions of a jnani are meant for a karma yogi. But now in the next few verses, we'll see that Krishna is going to make a more direct comparison between, whether it's between a karma yogi and a jnani or different karma yogis, we will see that, right? So now the comparisons are going to become far more clearer, far more direct, and we will see that from the next verse, which is verse number 25 of the fourth chapter. So we'll listen to the verse, I'll give you a brief meaning, and then we'll discuss about it. Very interesting next few verses which are coming. As always, I have the shloka rendered here very beautifully and very clearly by Brother Shyam. We'll listen to that and then we'll discuss about it.
Daiva meva pare yajnam yogina paryupasate brahma gnava pare yajnam yajnenaivopajuhvati.
Other yogis undertake sacrifice to gods alone. Others offer the self as a sacrifice by the self itself in the fire of Brahman. So that's verse number 25. Krishna spoke about the ideal yajna scenario, seeing everything involved as Brahman, right? So that is the ultimate in the idea of a yajna, where you are doing the offering or making the offering to the Supreme Lord. But then he gives the idea of an ideal yajna, that is, that performed by a jnani who sees everything. the receiver as Brahman, the giver as Brahman, the process as Brahman and everything. Now, if you look at that, that is the ultimate goal of every journey when we're talking about the spiritual path. If you take the journey of bhakti, the bhakti marga, what is the ultimate in the bhakti marga? The bhakti, the bhakta and Bhagwan have to merge and become one. When you talk about the path of meditation or dhyana, Swami would say the dhyata, the dhyeya and the dhyana have to become one, which means the meditator, the meditated upon and the process of meditation has to merge. So similarly, even in the case of a perfect yajna, the one who performs the yajna, the one who is receiving the yajna and the process of yajna itself has to merge. And that was what was described in the Brahmarpanam Shloka. But till one gets to that state, there can be any number of processes. For example, we spoke about bhakti itself. The bhakti, the bhakta and the bhagwan have to become one and the same. But till that union is achieved, the bhakta and bhagwan can have different relationships. The relationship of a mother and a child, the relationship of a master and a servitor, what we refer to as dasya, the relationship of a friend, sakya bhakti. There are different forms of bhakti, though the goal in everything is so that the bhakti and bhagwan, the bhakta and the bhagwan merge. The processes can be in any number of ways, right? And when we speak of the idea of merger, what do we mean by that? When you're talking about merger in the case of a yajna, it is not a physical merger. The person doing the yajna does not have to jump into the fire and become one with it, right? That's certainly not the idea. The concept is everything is ultimately one. Right? That is the truth. That's the ultimate supreme truth. There is no two. Everything is one. The sadhaka's mind has to grasp this truth. Right? So there is not going to be a physical oneness, but the mind has to comprehend and be established in this idea that there is only one and there is no two. So in the mind of the aspirant, all the names and forms should become Brahman and Brahman alone. And how does that happen? It happens only when there is antakarna shuddhi, or when the mind is completely purified, right? We've spoken about this even in the second and third chapter. The prerequisite for one to receive this jnana is to have this antakarna shuddhi, or sometimes synonymously spoken of as chitta shuddhi, or purification, the purity of the mind. And the process which we refer to as yajna is one of the ways that is being suggested by Lord Krishna here, when he says that it is a process that does not mind, and it's a process that can lead to antakarna shuddhi. He doesn't say this here, but towards the end of this chapter, he's going to mention that how all these processes of yajna are a means of achieving that antakarna shuddhi, which prepares you for having that jnana. In the Vedic context, if you look at it, a yajna has this very specific meaning of what is done by sitting before a fire. You traditionally build this Homa Kunda or Yajna Kunda. There are specifications of how it has to be built, with what material it has to be built, with what you kindle the fire and all of that. It's a very traditional, ritualistic and well-documented procedure, right? So that is what is often referred to as yajna. And most of these yajnas are performed making the dedication or making the offering to one particular Vedic deity. And if you look at some of the Vedas, and I'm sure some of you have been listening to the Veda Jignasa program, which Brother Ganesh from Radio Sai and Brother Bhargav are conducting, they speak about a lot of these Vedic concepts. And I'm sure they must have mentioned these Vedic deities like the Rudras, the Varunas, the Marutas, and the Shakti is one of the deities. Indra is one primordial deity. All of these are referred to as different deities to whom the yajnas are performed, right? So in this verse, as I mentioned, Krishna is making a direct comparison between a jnani and others who are in the path. And here, I think specifically he's referring to the Mimamsakas. We spoke about the Mimamsakas the last time around. The Mimamsakas are those who have taken to the ritualistic yajna path, right? They take upon the ritualistic yajna as one of the important means of worship and discipline in their life. So Krishna says in this verse, apare yoginaha, some yogis. The word apare suggests that there are different types of yogis and aspirants, right? So you will find this word and synonyms of this word repeating in the next few verses. He says, apare yoginaha, some yogis, daivameva, to devatas alone, yajnam paryupasate, perform yajnas. So there are some yogis who perform yajnas dedicated to some devatas, daivameva, to some devatas alone. So this is being contrasted with the idea of brahmarpanam brahmahavir. There it was offered to Brahman the Supreme, right? Even if we don't talk about the idea of a jnani, probably even a yogi who is making this offering with the idea that this is ultimately going to the Supreme Lord, it could be even a comparison with that, right? But the Mimamsakas, those who traditionally perform many of these yajnas, as I said, there are specific deities for whom they perform these yajnas. The process of yajna offering, making an offering to a specific deity, does not necessarily take you to the ultimate. At best, you can earn some good karma through that process, or you can achieve a place in the heaven, because you cannot attain liberation unless Brahma Ivatena Gantavyam, Brahma Karma Samadhina. Brahman is reached only when you think of everything as Brahman alone. But nevertheless, those yogis who do these yajnas this way too, that is making offering to specific devatas, as long as the process of performing this yajna is done sincerely and diligently, the action itself will lead to Chitta Shuddhi. This is why probably Krishna is using the term pariupasate. Upasate itself means to worship or to perform puja. Pariupasate means one who sincerely and diligently performs a worship. And in this case, the worship we are talking about is the yajna. So most of these yajnas, when they chant a mantra, you know, some of you would have been a witness to these homas and yajnas. Many of those happen in Prashanti Nilayam too. Every year we have the Dashara Yajna, which happens, and during other occasions we have devotees performing these yajnas. If you look at it, they will chant something and they will offer probably ghee or til seeds or sometimes sacred rice. Many of these offerings are made, and each time that offering is made, there will be a phrase or a sentence of a mantra being chanted. And invariably, when they make that offering, they would chant the phrase which goes like, idam na mama, or something to that effect. Idam na mama. The meaning of that statement, idam na mama, is, this is not mine. So if you look at it, even in a traditional ritualistic yajna, though it is offered to a specific deity and invariably the act is performed for the fulfillment of a certain desire, the yajna itself involves a very purifying process where the aspirant is offering one's own efforts and one's own resources to God, saying, this is no more mine, idam na mama. And whatever is the blessing that comes from it, I will take it as prasadam. And this is the whole process, right? This is the whole cycle that Krishna referred to in the third chapter. So the process itself may not give oneness with Brahman, which is the ultimate goal, but certainly the process prepares the mind for it. So Krishna doesn't say so in this particular verse. As I said, it's going to come a little later, but this whole process of yajna prepares the mind by giving it antakarna shuddhi, so that it is ready to receive that jnana. In the next line, Krishna says, apare, again, some others, brahmagnav, in the fire of Brahman, yajnam yajnena eva upajuhvati, offer as yajna, yajna itself. That's the literal meaning of yajnam yajnena eva upajuhvati. Now, this is a little complicated, this line. To be honest, I don't claim to understand this completely, and I'm not going to be saying this meaning with complete surety. All this interpretation or explanation I'm giving is not going to be said very confidently. I could not find Swami's explanation on this particular statement in the Gita Vahini or in the other verses. So that's why I'm not very confident of what I'm saying. But nevertheless, based on few of the commentaries, what the other commentators and writers have said, let's examine this particular statement. Yajnam yajnene eva upajuhvati. As I said, the statement literally means others offer yajna itself as a yajna in the fire of Brahman. Now, different commentators give different explanations for this, one of which is, this line is a description of a sannyasi. As I explained the last time, a mimamsaka is one who considers such yajnas and rituals as the means to God, right? So they look upon performing such ritualistic worship as part of their duty or as part of their dharma. And when you consider a sannyasi, a person who is a renunciant, or a sannyasi is also a yogi, right? Sannyasa yoga we call it. So he is also a yogi, a karma yogi is also a yogi. So this kind of a yogi, apare yoginaha, that's why he says, there are other yogis who are trying to approach God by sacrificing the idea of sacrifice itself, if I could put it that way. If you consider doing yajnas as a part of a karma that is being done as one's own duty, when you say yajnena, yajnam yajnena eva bujikvati, the idea of performing these ritualistic karmas itself is being offered as a sacrifice, right? So in that sense, this line could be a description of a sannyasi. The first line is a description of a mimamsaka or a person who believes in the karmakanda, who says, I perform all of these rituals and I make an offering to Indra, I make an offering to Varuna and all of these people because that's part of my duty. A sannyasi is one who renounces his duty, renounces his duties towards the family, duties towards his lineage and everything. So he sacrifices these karmas itself, and that could be one of the meanings of yajnam yajnena eva upajihvati. Another explanation that is given is based on a statement that occurs in Purusha Suktam. And Purusha Suktam is a very popular verse from the Rig Veda, and I'm sure many of our listeners would be pretty well versed in that. There is this one statement in Purusha Suktam which is very similar to what is the statement that is being made here. And the line is, Yagyena Yajnam Ajayantaha Devaha. Right? This is the verse, this is the line which comes in Purusha Suktam. Yajnena yajnam ayajanta devaha. In this statement, the word yajna is used with dual meanings. One is, of course, sacrifice, and the other is the supreme being. I think in one of the earlier episodes when we first spoke about yajna, we spoke about the various meanings that Swami gives for the word yajna. And one of the meanings that Swami says yajna is it's a name for Lord Vishnu or the all-pervasive Lord, all-pervading Lord, right? So, if you look at it from that point of view, the statement in this particular verse, Brahmagnau apare yajnam yajnena eva upajahvati, will mean now, some, picturing the Supreme Lord, perform yajna by offering in the fire of Brahman. So this also makes sense, because then it becomes a direct comparison with what Krishna is saying in the first statement. Some yogis perform yajnas offering to devatas, some offer yajna by making the offering to the Supreme Lord, considering the fire itself as the manifestation of that Supreme Lord or Brahman. But whichever way be the interpretation, whichever you choose to accept as the right interpretation, the point is, Krishna is referring to different types of yogis and the yajna, and the point is, all actions performed as a yajna do not bind, but end up purifying the mind. And in the verses to follow, Krishna is going to extend and extrapolate this idea of yajna itself. Right, so till now the description has been direct. We'll see after this, the whole concept of yajna is going to be expanded and is going to be given to us in a new light. So we listen to the next verse, which is verse number 26. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss it in detail.
Shrotradinindriyanyanye samyamagnishu juhvati shabdadin vishayanyanya indriyagnishu juhvati.
Some again offer the organ of hearing and other senses as sacrifice in the fire of restraint. Others offer sound and other objects of the senses as sacrifice in the fire of the senses. So that is verse number 26 of chapter 4. As I just said, now Krishna begins to expand this idea of the concept of yajna. We use the Brahmarpanam shloka as a food prayer, right? And thereby we are converting a simple and mundane act of eating into a yajna. Similarly, when anything is taken up as a yajna, it not only does not bind, but it also purifies the mind. And if you really look at it, there is this beautiful discourse where Swami speaks about the different flaws of the mind, and Swami says one of the flaws is the flaw of mala. And speaking about mala, Swami says, how does that flaw of the mind come? It is the dirt that the mind accumulates through the various sense organs. And speaking about that, Swami says the remedy for that is to keep a watch on ahara and vihara, what you intake as food and all your practices. And then Swami says food is not only what you eat, food is also what you take through the senses. And then there Swami speaks about the Brahmarpanam prayer and how it works, that it purifies all that goes inside, right? So if you look at it, the Brahmarpanam prayer itself is meant for purification of the mind, and it is connected to the idea of a yajna. So anything that is taken up as a yajna, it not only does not bind you in action, it also purifies the mind. And what is a yajna or a sacrifice? We had seen one of the definitions that Swami had given. Swami had said that you let go of something to receive something. That letting go is a sacrifice, Swami said. And Swami went on to say, but a wise person or the spiritually inclined person lets go of the worldly in the pursuit of the spiritual. He lets go of something which is lower to gain something which is far more higher, right? So Swami had said that that is a true yajna or a sacrifice. So with that idea, let us see what Krishna is saying in the following verses. In this particular verse, let's first concentrate on that. He says, anye, others, shrotradin indriyani. He says, as I said, anye, there it was apare, here the other synonym is used is anye, which means there are a few others, they take up this path. What is that path? Shrotradin indriyani. Shrotra means the organ of hearing, or the ear, right? Indriyani means the senses. So when Krishna says Shrotradini Indriyani, it means the organ of hearing and the other senses, like the eyes, the tongue, skin and the nose. Samyama Agnishu Juhvati. The word Samyama means self-restraint or self-mastery. So he says Samyama Agnishu means in the fire of self-restraint, Juhvati, they sacrifice it. So Krishna had said that some yogis perform a yajna and make offering to devatas. Here he says, some perform a yajna by offering their own senses in the fire of self-restraint or self-control. So Krishna refers to the act of controlling the senses also as a yajna. Or the act of controlling the senses can also be performed as a yajna and it will benefit the aspirant. And in a very beautiful imagery, he says, self-control itself is the fire. That's why he calls it Samyama Agni. Samyama Agni, he says, right? The act of controlling the senses itself can be considered a yogic fire in which the sense organs are offered. In the next line, he says, Anye, others, Shabdadin Vishayan. In the first line, Krishna had said, Shrotradini Indriyani, the organs of hearing and the other senses. Now he says, Shabdadin Vishayan. Shabda is sound, the sense object that the ear interacts with. There it was Shrotra, here it is Shabda. Here it is a sense object, there it was the sense organ. So he says, Shabdadin Vishayan means sound and other such objects of the senses, which is sight, taste, smell, etc. Right? So there it was Shrotradini Indriyani, the sense organ of hearing and the other sense organs. Here he says, Shabdadin Vishayan, the object of the sense organ of hearing, which is sound, and the other sense objects, right? And then he says, the sense objects, Juhvati, are offered in the Indriyagni, the fire of the senses. So some people consider the act of consuming through the senses itself as a yajna. That is the essence of this statement. And even that can become a yogic practice. And what is the best example of that? What we all do, what we spoke of in the previous shloka. We are supposed to consider the act of eating itself as a yajna. And as I said in that discourse 1990, Samukos Swami says, everything that is consumed through the senses is a form of eating. And this Brahmarpanam shloka actually applies to all of that, right? When you say that I offer what I see, what I breathe, what I eat, what I act and what I hear and what I speak, everything to God, that also becomes a form of a Brahmarpanam shloka, right? So we are supposed to consider, he says some yogis consider the act of offering the sense objects to the senses itself as a yajna. So both of these kinds of yajnas appear similar to us. What is the difference between what Krishna is saying here? But there is a difference, and that is why Krishna is making a reference to both of these separately. We will first speak about the second line, where the senses are the fire and the sense objects are the offering. The moment we have this attitude that a sense that, you know, my eyes and my ears are the processes or are the fire through which I am offering to the Lord who is sitting within. Right? So that is the whole imagery that Krishna is giving here. The sights that I see, the sounds that I hear, the fragrances that I take in, all of these are the ahuti or the havihi or the offerings that you put into the yajna fire. And the fire is the sense organs of the eyes, the nose, the ears and everything. And when we are putting it in the fire, what are we hoping? It reaches the God who is within, right? The moment I have this attitude or I have this imagery in my mind, I will tend to stop and think, is what I am consuming acceptable to Swami, isn't it? So it will automatically lead to a certain amount of discrimination on what you are consuming. There's this very beautiful episode, I think I must have mentioned it on the other shows, but I think it's quite apt to repeat it here. There was this devotee from the 1960s and 50s who had observed this particular habit of Swami, that sometimes when Swami gives an interview, and Swami, they would be waiting for Swami on the first floor of the mandir, because Swami would go up for his lunch. Sometimes after an interview, Swami would come and Swami would look a little pale, Swami would look a little sick. He would say, I don't feel like eating. Sometimes he would go into his room or bathroom and he would start vomiting. And then Swami will have some kind of stomach cramps and he'll lie down. So they observed this, that sometimes Swami would behave like this, especially after giving interviews to some people. So this devotee asked Swami, what is the problem? You know, why is it that Swami is suffering like this? And then Swami revealed that, I'm very, very allergic to this smell of cigarette. So there are some devotees who come to Prashandalyam, and those were the days when it was not very strict. These people used to go outside, people who are addicted to that habit. So they would go out, they would smoke. Swami would say that I called them for an interview and they would have just had a smoke and come in. And Swami said that I'm so allergic to that smell that if I get that odor, it immediately leads to this kind of, it upsets my stomach, I get stomach cramps and I can't eat food. And there are times when this devotee is observed that Swami would go hungry the entire day. That's how sick Swami would fall after getting that smell of cigarettes. And he narrated another incident where Swami was once traveling to another village in Tamil Nadu, and Swami was in the car when there was this person who was standing by the roadside. He was just curious as to see who's this person in this big car, and you know, there's a huge convoy of cars, and this person was smoking a bidi, you know, a country cigarette, and he peeped into Swami's car to see, you know, who's this person, and literally he smoked into the car. And again, that was another occasion where he saw Swami literally suffer physically when somebody, when Swami had to take this odor of cigarette smoke. So when this was happening, this devotee had asked Swami, "Swami, why do you then call these people for an interview? If you're so averse to that smell, why don't you avoid such people?" And Swami very beautifully and lovingly said, "See, they all have come here to be transformed. And they need my love to be transformed. And if I avoid them because I am not able to accept it, then how will they turn to the right path?" Right? But then Swami went on to say something which was very beautiful, very significant, and which is very important to what we are talking about now. Swami told that devotee, keep this image of Swami suffering in your mind. You know, you've seen me suffer after taking the smell, and Swami said, I'm equally allergic to the smells of alcohol and any such intoxicating substance. Swami said, keep this image of Swami clenching the stomach and suffering like this, and remember that Swami is not anywhere else. Swami is within your heart. And any time you give yourself into any of these habits that I don't like, imagine me sitting inside your heart and clenching my stomach and suffering like this. Swami said, if you have that image in your mind, you will ensure that you never do anything that is not acceptable to Swami. You will not drink, you will not smoke, you will not take to the consuming of any object which you are aware that Swami doesn't like, right? So when we live with this attitude that the sense objects are the offerings, to the God within, and the senses are the Agni or the Yajna fire, there will be a certain amount of discrimination as to what is good, what is acceptable, and how much is acceptable, right? Such sense control through discrimination is referred to as Dama, right? In the spiritual parlance, the word which is used for that is Dama. You do not completely deny the sense organs, the sense objects, but you judiciously choose what sense objects you allow the sense organs to interact with. So Krishna says, this itself is a form of Yajna which will purify you. But what Krishna referred to in the first line is the process of denying the senses completely. More than denying, it is having the mind absorbed in the self in such a manner that the senses do not get affected anymore. Right? This is referred to as Shama, where one completely refrains the senses, and these two, Shama and Dama, are the first two qualities to acquire in the spiritual path. The first two of what is referred to as the Shakt Sampattis. And these are extensively spoken about in the Brahma Sutras. Swami has written about it extensively and spoken about it extensively. Probably we'll come to that in a later part when we're talking about the Bhagavad Gita and the later verses itself. But these two lines of this particular shloka refer to Shama and Dama. So the first line speaks about Shama, which is a state of tranquility of the mind by completely mastering the senses, but that itself is achieved only through Dama or judicious use of the senses. And that is why in the first line Krishna uses the word Samyama. Of course, I translated that word as self-restraint or self-control, but the word Samyama has a very specific meaning in reference to yoga. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, the three final stages of the Ashtanga Yoga are referred to as Dhyana, Dharana and Samadhi. Together, Dhyana, Dharana and Samadhi are referred to as Samyama. Right? So what Krishna refers to in the first line is a complete mastery over the senses and the ability to be absorbed in the self while the second is a state where you use the senses judiciously or wisely. The second line speaks about dhamma or sense control, which then leads to what is spoken of in the first line of that verse, which is shama, where the mind is totally unaffected by the senses. But in both lines, the word juhvati is used, which means the sadhaka chooses to do the yajna. The sadhaka chooses to control. The sadhaka chooses to exercise self-restraint. And that is the key to yajna. Being aware that I want something more than just sense pleasures. I must consciously offer the lesser pleasures for a higher goal, as Swami defined what yajna is all about. So that is verse number 26. A very, very beautiful imagery of, you know, and very relatable, isn't it? And our blessing to have lived with Swami, we know what is right and wrong a little more clearly probably. Swami says everyone knows, whether you have seen Swami or not, whether you have come to the avatar or not, everyone has a conscience and everyone knows. But we, even in a practical way, we have seen what Swami likes, what Swami doesn't like. We have heard from Swami himself what is good, what is bad. So probably a little more, even the superficial mind also understands what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And in that sense, this whole imagery of a yajna relating to the senses, the sense organs, the sense objects, and the idea of self-restraint is very, very relatable, right? So we'll go to the next verse. The topic continues. The concept is still about the yajnas. So we listen to verse number 27 of the fourth chapter.
Sarvani indriya karmani prana karmani chapare atma samyama yogagnau juhvati jnana deepite.
Others again sacrifice their activities and their vitality in the spiritual fire of self-abnegation, kindled by wisdom. That is verse number 27. The previous verse spoke of yogis who are still very much in the world, right, performing their dharma. One is a person living a moral life where consciously they consume through their senses what is acceptable. And the other are those who are able to completely withdraw their senses at will, right? They're still in the world, they're still operating and doing their dharma. But as I said, the samyama refers to dhyana, dharana and samadhi. They're able to withdraw themselves, completely concentrate on what they're meditating upon and reach a state of samadhi. But in this particular verse, Krishna speaks about those who have completely given up all activities and contact with the world. He says, Sarvani indriyani karmani, all activities pertaining to the senses, and prana karmani cha, and all the functions of the pranas, which essentially means all actions, because the pranas are the vital energies and there is no action that can be performed without them. So Krishna says, there are others, apare, who give up all actions of the jnanendriyas and the karmendriyas. Sarvani indriya karmani prana karmani cha. And for this yoga, what is the fire? Atma samyama yoga agnau. This type of yogis offer or give up all activities in the fire of atma samyama yoga, or complete self-abnegation or sannyasa. In the previous verse, Krishna said samyama agni. Here he says atma samyama yoga agni. Though the word samyama is common in both of these, atma samyama yoga is a different topic by itself. In the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the chapter itself is called Atma Samyama Yoga. We will talk about that more specifically. But in a way, it is an extension of the Sannyasa Yoga that Krishna speaks about in the fifth chapter. And from there, he says Atma Samyama Yoga. And of course, in the entire Bhagavad Gita, Krishna keeps making all of these concepts much, much more accessible to people who are still leading life in the world, performing their duty. So in that sense, he will redefine Atma Samyama Yoga too. But generally, Atma Samyama Yoga is referred to as total self-abnegation, which is associated with renunciation or sannyasa. So here we can say that the reference is to a sannyasa lifestyle where one gives up all activity and dharma or duty. But Krishna adds, Atma Samyama Yoga Agnav Juhvati Jnana Deepite. This type of yogi offers all activities of the Jnanendriyas and Karmendriyas, the senses of perception and action, into the fire of Atma Samyama Yoga. Jnana Deepite, kindled by Jnana. We are talking of a very, very high level of sacrifice here, which calls for immense vairagya or detachment, right? And this detachment has to be kindled by something. The detachment has to have a source. In general, vairagya is kindled or inspired by two things. One is virakti and the other is viveka. Now, virakti is a certain kind of a feeling of apathy, which is, or disinterest, which is born of, say, disappointment or an unpleasant event. Say people have a huge loss in business, or they lost a loved one, or they have a failure in their love life. And in that sadness and depression, that is referred to as virakti. One will become very dispassionate and one will suddenly get so detached from everything, right? But Swami says such vairagya is very short-lived. When things change and when things around you improve, then the vairagya also goes with it, right? So vairagya can be inspired by virakti too, but that vairagya does not necessarily stay. There are people who have managed to hold on to that vairagya even though it has come from virakti, right? There are examples of that, but mostly this vairagya, I'm sure all of us would have felt at some point in time. In fact, there are different types of vairagya which is spoken of. Smashana vairagya is one of them. When you attend a funeral and when you see a person being burnt on the pyre, they say that instantly you feel, oh, what am I running after all these riches and it's not worthwhile, right? And you go back home, you have a bath and you eat your food and you're back to your normal life, right? So vairagya, which is kindled by virakti, is very fleeting, right? The other way vairagya is kindled is through viveka or wisdom. So when one gives up the world, knowing well that the world is ephemeral, that it is an illusion and it cannot give the true bliss one is seeking, that becomes a vairagya which is kindled by viveka. So here Krishna is referring to such vairagya. He says, Jnana Deepite. It is kindled by jnana. The renunciation that he is talking about here is kindled by jnana or such wisdom. In the next few verses, Krishna summarizes and mentions a few more this type of yajnas or the symbolism of yajnas. Maybe we'll take up one more verse. We started a little late, so I think we can push a little forward and I'll cover just one more verse. Because in this verse, Krishna summarizes a few more, right? Not so much in detail, but very beautifully he touches upon few other types of yajnas. So we'll listen to that, we'll talk about that briefly, and we'll conclude with that. So this is verse number 28.
Dravya yajna stapo yajna yoga yajna statha pare Swadhyaya jnana yajnyascha yatayas samshitau rataha.
Similarly, others are performers of sacrifices through wealth, through austerity, through yoga, and through study and knowledge. Others are ascetics with severe vows. So in this verse, Krishna quickly summarizes and names a few other types of yajnas. And we'll see how it covers almost all types of spiritual endeavors. Krishna is giving each one of it a status of a yajna. But of course, there are some caveats. We'll re-emphasize that towards the end of it. But for now, Krishna is saying, Tata apare. So too, there are others like Dravya yajnaha. Now here in this particular verse, the word yajnaha means those who perform a yajna, right? So when he says dravya yajnaha, the word dravya means material possessions or objects that one possesses, right? So a dravya yajnaha are those who sacrifice their wealth in charity. They perform the yajna of charity, right? Then he goes on to say tapo yajna, performing tapas as yajna. The word tapas is often translated as austerities or rigorous practice of meditation and so on. But any discipline taken up can be called a form of tapas. Some take up fasting, some take a diksha that for a few weeks they will, you know, wake up in the morning, do a certain puja, they will avoid eating such things. Right? Many, many temples, people, pilgrims who go to many temples take up such dikshas, right? So all of these can be considered different forms of tapas. But of course, Swami gives a very beautiful, simple meaning of the word tapas. It is simple, but it will take a lifetime to follow that tapas. Swami says, true tapas is purity and unity of thought, word and deed, right? But of course, in this particular verse, Krishna says, some people offer their tapas, or what I said, such kind of rigorous lifestyles as a yajna. So he says, tapo yajna. There are people who offer their tapas as yajna. Then he goes on to say, yoga yajnaha. People who take up different forms of prescribed yogas and offer that as a yajna. We have, I'm sure, come across a few such yogas. There is the Patanjali's yogas is a technique, the Hatha yoga, the Kundalini yoga, and I'm sure there'll be many, many others. I'm not very well versed with them. But there are many forms of yogas, right? There are very specific paths with very specific prescribed yogic practices and disciplines and, rules and regulations, right? So there are some people who take up such yogic paths. And then he goes on to say, swadhyaya jnana yajnascha. The word swadhyaya means the study of the scriptures. But of course, in the Vedic context, it is the recitation of the Vedas. Swadhyaya would refer to a daily practice of recitation of Vedas. And typically, if you look at it, each family lineage, each family tree would be associated with a certain section of the Vedas. And people belonging to that lineage would have this duty of regularly chanting that particular Veda. It was a means by which the Vedas were preserved, right? We know how Vyasa made partitions in the Vedas and it was given to different lineages, and that's how it was preserved and passed down to us. So Swadhyaya in a very traditional sense means this sitting down and reciting these mantras which have been passed on to you through your family lineage. So there, that is what the traditional sense of what Swadhyaya is. But if you look at it, there are, in general, it can be spoken about as the study of the scriptures itself. And Krishna, when he says Swadhyaya Yajna, is referring to, I feel, a general study or taking up the study of any scriptures. In fact, Swami in his in the Gita Vaini itself refers to this as studying any spiritual text. Swami uses the word moksha shastras. Any spiritual text which is kind of taking you towards the ultimate goal can be, the study of any such text can be spoken of as a form of swadhyaya. In fact, very beautifully Swami says, swadhyaya is a form of repaying rishi runam. Right? This is a phrase that Swami uses quite often in his discourses. Rishi runam means, a debt. Rishi runam means the debt that we owe to some of these great saints and sages who have compiled this wisdom in the form of scriptures, in the form of Puranas, in the form of Vedas, in the form of Vedantic literature and all of this, right? So when we take up the study of these, Swami says that we are repaying a debt that we owe to them. Because we do not have the energy, the time and the focus to be able to derive at some of these esoteric truths. Somebody has done it to us, at least we owe them the duty of taking up the study of these scriptures. So Swami says when you do the Swadhyaya Yajna, it is a process by which you are settling this Rishi Runam that you have. So the scriptures, the Puranas and all of these, study of that can be referred to as Swadhyaya. Then comes Jnana Yajna, the contemplation on the Vedantic truth. The Shravana, Manana and Nididhyasana of such esoteric truth is referred to as Jnana Yajna. Finally, Krishna says, Yatayaha Samshitta Vrataha, those who follow very rigorous and rigid vows. So Krishna covers all kinds of spiritual efforts and calls all of them a form of yajna. In fact, he is not yet done. There are a couple of other verses where Krishna is going to speak a little more about that. He's going to mention a few more sadhanas. But all of this is centered around two points: doing them purposefully and doing them driven by the desire for jnana, or at least antakarna shuddhi, or purification of the mind. Right? These two are very, very important. When we spoke about dravya yajna, charity itself as a yajna, it is not simply giving away the excess that we have. It's not because I have more money or I have more objects than I need and I'm giving it away. But doing it with a specific purpose, that this act is going to take me closer to God, or this act is going to purify me from within, and to be consciously doing that, right? And in fact, in the Gita Vahini, when Swami speaks about Tapo Yajna, Swami says this very beautifully and crisply. Swami says, and I quote, "When all physical activities, mental activities and speech are utilized for spiritual discipline, then it becomes offerings of penance or Tapo Yajna. How can it be spiritual penance or tapas if you have lain down due to weakness arising from missing a meal?" End of quote. So Swami says there are other weaknesses and other situations which might make you skip a meal. That does not become tapas. For some reason, you know, in Swami's college when we were studying, we had credits for the awareness program in which we had to study the Bhagavata Vahini, we had to study the Ramakatha Rasavahini. Literally, we've been forced to study. That does not become a Swadhyaya Yajna, right? So this has to be taken up consciously, saying that I have to take up this, I am doing this as a yajna. And again, the definition of a yajna is I am offering something lower in the pursuit of something higher, right? That attitude should always be there. So the emphasis all through is what Krishna said, jnana dipite, kindled by the thirst for knowledge. So that should be the driving factor. And in all this, what is Krishna's agenda? What is the agenda that Krishna is pushing? Krishna is very, very focused. It looks like Krishna is telling all these kind of things. Where did we start with? We started off in the battlefield. How is all this related to that? It is all completely related to what Krishna said to Arjuna, and the focus has never shifted. Arjuna wanted to become a sannyasi. Arjuna wanted to pursue knowledge. He thought it is not worthwhile fighting. But all through, Krishna is trying to tell him, do you think that is the only way to achieve the ultimate spiritual goal? All these can be methods by which you achieve the spiritual goal. Swami would often say this, the mothers who are cooking in the kitchen, or the people who are sweeping the floor, all of these acts can be made a spiritual act. And this few verses that we went through is a sneak preview of that, or a beautiful description of that, where every act can be converted into a yajna, and all that it requires is one must have that conscious feeling that I am doing this in pursuit of something higher. I am not satisfied with the pleasures that the world offers. I seek the ultimate, right? So that should be the goal, as Swami says. When that focus is there, when that one-pointed attention is there, everything that one performs can become a yajna, and one can consciously do that. So with that, dear listeners, we'll conclude this week's episode. I'll join you again next week. We'll continue with the fourth chapter and continue with this concept of yajna itself. A couple of verses are there which are very beautiful. I thank you all for joining me. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'll be shortly joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the last segment of today. I'll meet you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.